It is my distinct pleasure to introduce this morning a man who graduated from this seminary about 20 years ago. Since he graduated, he's seen a lot of changes going on in the parishes as far as ethnic makeups. He was first called to Venezuela and spent 11 years there. In that ministry, he was involved in urban ministry. He was involved in the Spanish Lutheran Hour and church planting in that country. After that, he was called to El Paso, Texas, where he was a pastor in a congregation there for 10 years, which was primarily an Anglo or a white congregation in a pretty much completely Hispanic community. And while he was there, he was involved in developing two Hispanic ministries. He was involved in organizing a group called Friends for the Border, in organizing training for future church workers of the Missouri Synod in dealing with Hispanics. And he is presently the director of mission education at the International Synod and in the International Center. His topic today is ministering in a changing neighborhood. And he will be speaking specifically about the demographic changes in the United States, his experience with that, especially dealing with El Paso, also the future that we will have as ministers in dealing with that same type of demographic change, and then some of the blessings that we will all be experiencing in the church individually here. It's my privilege to introduce to you Steve Huey. Could we give him a warm welcome, please?
Good morning. Good to be with you this morning. Hope everybody's comfortable here. It's good to be back after a number of years, and yet so many things are similar, too. Actually, we could talk not only about ministering in a changing neighborhood, but about ministering in a changing world. As Ted said, I'd like to share a little bit about how the changes that are occurring in our neighborhoods and our world are affecting congregational life in the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod, a little bit about my own personal experience with ministering in a changing neighborhood or ethnic community, and the implications all of this has for the LCMS, for our congregations, and for Concordia Seminary, for the students, for you, and for your future ministry. And then also the opportunities and blessings that these changes may give us and to the church. I don't know if you mentioned this, Ted, but there are some materials about ethnic ministry, various kinds of newsletters that our office produces, such as the Black Ministry Newsletter, Communities, and the newest one on Hispanic Ministry. Those are available over there at the door. You may take a copy if you like. As we look at our world today, we see an incredible number of demographic changes and realities affecting our society, our congregational life, and our own personal lives. Recently, I was talking with a new sem grad from last year's class here at the seminary who's now working in Metro New York. He's in his mid-20s. His wife also is in her 20s. And they are the youngest members of their 200-member congregation. The next youngest person in their congregation is 55 years of age. Now, that's not a story I made up. I just talked to this young man about 2 weeks ago. This is a reality that we face in many of our changing areas of the United States. I asked him, what kind of opportunity does your church have? What will your ministry be? He says, well, I spend a lot of time counseling families who have experienced a bereavement, and I've had a lot of funerals in the last few months in my new ministry. But of course, he, like most young people or most pastors, are interested in seeing life and new life. He's interested in seeing baptisms occur, confirmation classes for young people. So I asked him, what kind of opportunity do you have? And he said, well, in the neighborhood, we have a lot of children. I see them playing in the street, and I hear them speaking strange languages. Some of those languages I don't even understand. He indicated that there were various groups, including East Europeans, Hispanics, and even Muslims. So he began to think how he might be able to work with that community. And yet he also knows, as most people begin to realize, that he might be in for some conflict and some difficulty as he tries to help an Anglo congregation make the kind of commitment that is necessary for such a ministry. Now, this is significant because it represents the kind of parish that some of you may be called to serve. Now, perhaps some of you have come from the Midwest or from smaller areas, towns or villages in the Midwest of the United States, where you have not seen so much of this change. But even in smaller areas, we're beginning to note the growing ethnic complexity of our society. The example I mentioned also symbolizes what's happening globally and increasingly in our own United States. With the increasing world population, the demographers are saying that by the year 2000, we'll have 7 billion people on planet Earth. Our world is fast becoming a global city. The population growth is taking place primarily in the poorer regions of the world. By the year 2000, there will be 58 cities of over 5 million people. That's compared with 29 today. So that will be doubling in just 10 years. And half of this increase comes from people who are escaping poverty in the countryside, who are looking for a new way of life. This is a worldwide phenomena, something that is occurring in Latin America and Asia and also parts of Africa. Reaching these masses of people in urban areas in the United States and the world will require a mission strategy much different from our former mission work, which was primarily directed to rural ministry in the bush, for example. Our own work in Venezuela for many years was directed to the rural people in eastern Venezuela. What we found after a number of years was that we were losing a great number of these people as they moved to the city of Caracas and other large cities looking for work. Why was this happening? Because we had no urban strategy and very few urban congregations to receive these people who were migrating and moving from the countryside into the rural areas. And as you move into a large city, it's very easy to be swallowed up by the change and by all of the opportunities that such a city gives to people. So we have to find, as we had tried to do in Venezuela, a new urban strategy. And we must also learn to develop an urban strategy here in the United States. For I believe that, to a great extent, our church is still operating with a rural mentality and a rural strategy. And that is key to our problem in terms of outreach and growth. Reaching the masses of people in the United States, then, will include a ministry that is carried out by LCMS pastors and lay people who are able to adapt to this new reality, who are able to see what the challenge is and are able to make the changes that are necessary for the situation. Now, the implications of this changing reality also affects the way seminary training is done and calls for, I believe, a reexamination of the premises upon which the present system is built. In fact, global urbanization is the most significant development in our time, and in turn has the greatest implications for you as a future pastor and for our church body and the individual congregations which form the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod. Note, for example, that this year, for the first time in history, 50% of the population of California is now Spanish-speaking. Together with other minority groups, this has made California the first, what we could call, third world state in the United States. We literally have the same kind of phenomena and opportunity for cross-cultural ministry in California that we might have in Africa or parts of Asia. The same kind of strategy, the same kind of approach must be taken by urban mission developers and pastors in our country today as we use in other countries across the sea. By the year 2000, 50% of the entire population of Canada is scheduled to be of foreign birth. Already it's approaching that kind of percentage. Now, think of the fact that we have a synod or a church body, our Lutheran Church in Canada, which is about the size of one of our larger districts, trying to reach out to a population of significant size and with half of the people being of foreign birth, and many of them from different cultures and different religious backgrounds. What a challenge that is for the new Church of Canada. The city of Phoenix, Arizona, is growing faster than the country of Kenya, which happens to be the fastest growing population in the world. Los Angeles is the second largest Mexican city in the world after Mexico City. And that is not the only thing that we could say about Los Angeles. And as the population grows in the United States, more and more of those who are young in our society are minorities, including Hispanics and blacks. Meanwhile, the white population, and this would, of course, relate to the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod, the white population is becoming increasingly older. This reality is especially true of the LCMS, which now has an average age of over 50 years. Now, notice something significant about the statistics and the facts that I've shared with you so far. Nearly all the growth and change I've cited is non-traditional, non-middle class, and non-successful in terms of Midwestern and Northern European values. These growing urban populations are presently and will continue to be, for the most part, single parents, single parent families that is, multilingual, homeless, hungry, and with limited educational background and skills. The North American city, including Chicago and Toronto, have literally become the two-thirds world. Now, how will you future pastors deal with the congregation that you serve that might be found in a changing neighborhood? How will you deal with the opportunities for helping your people see the harvest that is white for God's work? Will you be able to serve effectively in such a changing environment? How will tomorrow's pastors deal with cross-cultural conflict and help guide their congregations through the stormy seas of social change and ethnic diversity? Will the seminary continue to prepare men to effectively serve congregations which are being rocked by rapid change and new realities? How will it adjust its training and programs to this changing reality? How will we keep our emphasis on teaching the Scripture as it is shared with us, as we have received it from our forefathers? How will we be faithful and still be able to be effective? This is the challenge, and yet the opportunity facing us at this juncture in history. Now, before we go on and cite the opportunities this reality presents, let me outline and further illustrate the reality facing our church at this time and you as students in ministry at this present time. At this juncture, 50 vacancies exist in the Atlantic District. I was talking with the district president a few months ago about this, and he said that there is little chance for filling these pulpits, especially with experienced people who have families and who have economic realities to deal with as far as housing costs and other realities. The chances are greater, he said, that we might be able to get candidates who would be called to such congregations. I wonder how that makes some of you feel, that you might not have the same kind of economic realities as those who are already serving in ministry. We know that's not true, of course. And also, I think it must make you feel that perhaps they're saying these aren't as important, these ministries, because it doesn't require as much preparation. That's not the case at all. In fact, these are the most difficult ministries of all, the areas where the challenge is the greatest and where our brightest and best people should be called and who should be willing to serve. And just so we're not thinking that this is only something that is affecting our own church body. Also, a couple of months ago, I had the opportunity to talk to the bishop of the ELCA, who serves the Pacific Southwest region. He says that in the next 5 years, their synod expects to close at least 50 congregations. And this is because congregations in changing neighborhoods are unable to make the kinds of of adjustments that are necessary while they're still strong enough and invariably end up on subsidy and finally follow a certain predictable pattern which leads to a final death of a parish. Now, these 50 parishes are located in Southern California alone. And of course, there are many other areas in Chicago and other large cities where the same phenomena is taking place. And yet populations in metropolitan areas that I just mentioned are growing. It's not a matter of not having the opportunity to find people who might fill our churches and become disciples for Christ. There are many young people, as we heard in the example of the young seminarian in the metropolitan New York area, but they're not middle-class European youth. These are youth who are sometimes without jobs, without hope, and many times without direction. And we're not just talking about saltwater districts of the Lutheran Church or the ELCA or other synods. We're also talking about what's happening in many parts of the heartland. For example, Hispanic ministry is attempting to be done in a place like Garden City, Kansas, where I was last week. These are small towns, and places like Garden City have a tremendous challenge for a pastor who is able to work cross-culturally. At the present time, there's no Hispanic pastor, so the individual who's trying to serve that parish is a pastor of a fairly large Anglo congregation. This is something he's doing in his spare time, so to speak. What an incredible opportunity for him, but as he mentioned, what an incredible challenge I have just doing what I'm really called to do with the parish that I was called to serve. And now I'm being asked to work with people whose language I don't even understand. In Edmonton, Canada, where I visited last fall, I discovered 40,000 Hispanics and very few congregations to serve those people, not a single Lutheran congregation. And by the way, there are over 100,000 Asians living in the Edmonton area, giving our church an incredible opportunity to reach out to that growing population. Vancouver, Canada, while we're talking about Canada, has an increasing Chinese population made up of many who are fleeing from Hong Kong before the change occurs, looking for a new way of life. And unlike many of the immigrants who are coming to Southern California and Miami and other parts of our country, these are people who are very wealthy. In fact, the real estate prices in Vancouver are so out of sight that unless you really have a rich uncle, you might not want to accept the call to Vancouver if you're interested in owning your own home. Growing populations of ethnic people in the states that are traditionally unaffected is also occurring. I was in North Carolina about 2 weeks ago, which is my home state. I hadn't been there in a couple of years, and I found that North Carolina, of all places, which just 10 years ago figured as the state with the lowest Hispanic population, has gone through significant changes, and it's expected in the 90 census that this will become a state with a much larger percentage of Hispanics. What will the pastors in that area do as they are challenged also with a new reality that no one even dreamed about just a few years ago? And there are other realities, such as the moving target. That's a title that Ralph Winters and others give to the kind of mission situation we're facing today. You see, our target isn't standing still long enough for us to get a real good grip on what's happening. The target audience keeps moving around, and this occurs because people are moving from one country to another, looking for economic change or help. Many times looking for a way to deal with their system of government that is frustrating to them, and so forth. And then within the country, within our own United States of America, there is also immigration going on as people move back and forth. Recently, I was working with some Asian people in Minneapolis, St. Paul, and I discovered that many of those people were moving back to California. Also, the same thing is happening in Denver, where a large Asian population had begun to build. And then for some various reasons, these groups want to be closer to other family and to a sense of connectedness, I would say, with the Asian situation, and they move closer to California. So we have that moving target. How do you deal with building a congregation in St. Paul, Minnesota, where you have a Hispanic parish and the members stay for a year or two and move on to some other metropolitan area. How do you build a stable congregation with those kinds of realities? We have a pluralistic society, too, a greater emphasis on pluralism, which brings about a greater pressure to recognize and accept other religions. That's the message we get from our media, and that's the message that many of the people that you will serve in the parish will be saying and will be believing, so much so that you will have perhaps some difficulties at times showing them and convincing them that Jesus is the way, the truth, and the life, and that there is no other way to salvation except through him. And we have a growing influence also of independent evangelical and Pentecostal churches. One of the incredible phenomena of our time is the growth of these churches who are dependent upon their own resources, who have incredible ownership on the part of their members and their other people or pastors who come up out of the ranks to build the church in a particular place. At the same time, mainline congregations and synods are stagnating. Another reality is the Pacific Rim phenomena, as I call it. This is the real point of interest in mission today, the Pacific Rim. This means that now people are more and more looking to the Pacific as the arena where real mission work is going on and where the great interest today is occurring. The Korean church is a leader in what is happening in the worldwide mission movement. We have seen with great interest in the last few years an incredible growth of Korean churches here in the United States as 2,000 new Korean churches have been founded. We also see Korea as an incredible mission country, sending out now more Bibles than any other country in the world, including the United States. That's a thing that many times we're not aware of. Other countries are involved in reaching out with the Great Commission, and we may ourselves in a very short time be receiving Korean and other Asian pastors and workers and missionaries to serve in our inner cities, where perhaps our own pastors are not able to serve so effectively. Then we have the blending of world and North American ministries. In our own mission department, we've tried structurally to show this connection for a number of years. And yet it's becoming even more evident that these ministries have to be seen as an integrated ministry. North America and the world are one and the same kind of ministry. As we have people moving back and forth from Latin America, for example, it's extremely important that our Hispanic pastors and our Anglo pastors who are serving Hispanics in the United States know and relate to missionaries and pastors in Latin America. For many times, family members are living in the countries that these newly arrived immigrants have come from. They need to understand the kind of culture from which these people have come and work out common strategies to reach this moving target audience. And so there is a great need to look at, again, the challenge of world and North American ministries. All of these realities require new thinking, imagination, faith, and a sense of servanthood on the part of tomorrow's pastors. It requires a willingness to rethink traditional seminary training to make sure that we're not only understanding the scripture and the confessions, but how to communicate the message of God effectively to those whom God is sending to our culture and to those that he is sending us to serve. Now, from the big picture that I've shared with you, I'd like to turn now to my own personal experience, because I found in my own ministry and in preaching generally that I'm often helped the most by messages and sermons that are straight from the heart. It's one thing to see the big picture and to feel as frustrated as you must feel now after hearing all these statistics and thinking, what can I do about all of this? Why is he telling me? I mean, I'm just hoping to hang on with my own little area, or I'm ready to take on a parish but not the whole world. And that's right. I understand where you're coming from if that's what you're thinking. And so that's why I would like to share with you a realistic picture of what could happen to any of you as you receive a call to a congregation that may be going through a changing neighborhood syndrome. Don't think this can't happen to you, because increasingly this is what our pastors are dealing with. It's my hope that by sharing my experience, including some of the joys as well as some of the pains, you will realistically assess what lies before you, and I hope also look forward to the challenge and be ready to accept that and even be eager to move into it. As Ted indicated, after serving 11 years as a missionary in Venezuela, I received a call to do Hispanic work in El Paso, Texas. Before I accepted the call, I made sure that the opportunity I was receiving was also going to give me a chance to work directly with Hispanic people and to help develop a Hispanic ministry. I couldn't understand why it would be God's will to have put in so much time learning the Spanish language and understanding the culture and then be called into a purely Anglo kind of ministry. And so I wanted to be sure that I was doing the right thing. The congregation assured me that they were committed to Hispanic ministry and that the reason they were calling me instead of some other pastor is because I did speak Spanish and could help them make that transition that they knew they needed to make. When I got to El Paso, I discovered that I was dealing with a little different reality than the one that was communicated to me. Does this make you nervous as you think about your calls coming up and what they've told you already? First of all, I discovered that El Paso was significantly more Hispanic in terms of population than I had even thought, with over 65% of the population being of Hispanic origin, many of them from more recent times, as the number of people were coming from Mexico from that impoverished land. And also I discovered that the congregation I was serving was the mother congregation, which made it the oldest Lutheran church in that part of the Southwest. It had the reputation of being the mother church, the mothering congregation that had brought about six or eight daughter churches over the years. And yet as I read the history of the congregation, I saw that there had never been really any serious attempt to deal with the Hispanic reality, which had existed really from day one, because El Paso was originally a Hispanic settlement long before the first Anglos ever came. I also discovered that I needed to deal with the reality of the people in my congregation. And I will tell you this, I think the most positive thing that happened was the fact that having served as a missionary, I had learned the importance of knowing people, the people especially that I was called to serve, and to try to get inside of their moccasins, to really feel what they feel. So I made up my mind, even before I went to El Paso, that I was going to look at this group of Anglo people primarily as people who needed the gospel and who could possibly be God's servants in that setting, but I was going to try to realize and understand and deal with them as a unique subculture, recognizing that even if they are Anglos and speak the same language I speak, they probably have been through some kind of filter, making them somewhat different from Anglo people in the Midwest or in some other part of the United States. And that was a good hunch, because as it turns out, the place we live and the circumstances we deal with do make us somewhat different. And so we dealt with these people with the same kind of sensitivity as we tried to deal with Hispanics and with Venezuelans. But I was not prepared for some of the hostility that I dealt with, even on the first day of my ministry. After my installation, we were having a typical reception like you have, and several members of the congregation told me in very clear language that they had not voted for me, and they wanted me to know that if I had any idea about bringing Spanish-speaking people into this parish, I could forget it, or it would be over their dead body, or similar kinds of things. At that point, I knew I was dealing with a real challenge, and I felt that the idea that I had originally come with was probably even more important at this point, to become even more sensitive. Why are these people so uptight about this thing? Then I also have to say, I discovered there were some people in the congregation who felt very strongly that this was the direction we should move. And so this presents you with the interesting phenomena of some people being for it and some people being against it. How do you get them together working as a team? Some of the people finally helped me understand that the reason I was called is also some pressure from the district president and other parts of the church hierarchy, seeing the reality here, feeling that they should have a Spanish-speaking pastor, and putting the kinds of people on the list that would tend to have that inclination. So that's kind of how it all happened. I believe that the Lord was in this, nevertheless, because he does work through our human frailties and even through the structures that we sometimes question. Well, why did the people feel the way they did? We do need to look at some real realities, a lot of them having to do with economics. My experience has been that people tend to be the most anxious, fearful, when it has to do with their pocketbook. I mean, you're not so concerned about new immigrants in Vancouver, British Columbia, if you've got jobs and the number of Hispanics are relatively few. But when you're on the border and you're being overwhelmed and everybody in your neighborhood is now speaking Spanish, all of a sudden things take on a little different look. One of the examples I can share to help you see where these people were coming from is the fact that the county hospital, during the years I was there, developed a lawsuit with the United States government whereby they asked for a settlement of $50 million. The reason they gave was that this hospital was not or should not be unfairly treated just because of its geographic location about a mile and a half from the border of Mexico. For you see, what happened is most of the patients in that hospital were people from Mexico, not from El Paso, putting an incredible pressure upon the infrastructure and raising the cost of doing services in that place by a great amount. And so they felt that unless the U.S. government could guarantee that they wouldn't have to serve this population, they had only the choice as doctors and people of care to serve those who came to them. Very often the women would come to the hospital just in time to have their baby, and it was impossible for them to send them across the river. So consequently, they were able to have their baby and thereby have a new American citizen in their family. So you can see the kind of phenomena that was occurring. Also in the schools, tremendous pressures as the schools were trying to develop bilingual programs that would be fair to both the Hispanic children who needed to learn in their own language at first, and then also be fair to the Anglo children who already knew how to speak English. So you can see that we were dealing with a situation that was ripe for conflict. The thing that was most surprising to me was to find out that one of the groups of people who were the most hostile generally to the newly arrived Mexicans and other immigrants were Mexican people who had already been living there for a number of years. Later I discovered that this is a rather common phenomena among ethnic groups, and that quite often when a family or a group of people have made it, so to speak, they are the least helpful to the newly arrived group because the attitude is something like, I have mine, why don't they go away so I can keep what I have and not have to deal with this. I don't want to be reminded either of my own past and my own struggle that I may have had to go through. The other phenomenon I had to deal with in the parish was a kind of a maintenance ministry mentality on the part of many members. Little emphasis on mission, feeling that if we're doing some of the things that a church ought to do, like good worship services and Sunday school classes, that's really all we ought to expect. So why is there a big challenge to reach out now to all of these people? Those were then the kinds of issues that we faced. Now, what was the strategy to deal with this? My own feeling was that you can't share what you don't have. So the need that I saw right off the bat was to develop the worship and prayer life of the people. And that really begins also with the pastor. The importance of your own devotional life cannot be overemphasized, especially in this kind of challenging ministry. I did work hard on worship, developing a variety of worship forms, trying to be both loyal to the Lutheran tradition, but at the same time sensitive to our kind of community, and giving members of the congregation some of what they wanted, but at the same time what was really, I felt, helpful to them. The emphasis on group Bible study was emphasized so that we were able to have more people eventually in the Word, which I really believe and still do is one of the ways for people to go through the significant spiritual changes which have to precede any other kinds of changes we might like to see. Then I also began to work and build slowly toward a strategy of outreach by, first of all, looking at the church structure, and I discovered that, for one thing, the budget of the congregation reflected pretty much of an in-reach mentality, with very little money being used to help reach out to others besides our own group. I also felt that part of that reality was the need to help our young people from a very early age have a mentality of sharing their faith and witnessing. So in our confirmation classes, we tried to incorporate activities of outreach and witness, as well as the instruction, which is always part of our Lutheran approach. We developed a mission strategy through the development of an outreach board and several related committees, which was a new thing for our church, but this was very helpful because at least we had a forum in our council meetings and voters assemblies to talk about and deal with opportunities and challenges related to outreach. And then it was not only the pastor, but other key lay leaders who felt strongly about this kind of ministry who could be helpful and definitely were helpful. We developed also an awareness training program, which at first did more good for other congregations in the Southwest than for our own parish, because our people already felt like they understood Hispanics and the reality of that part of the world, so they didn't need a lot of help from somebody like me, who was, after all, a newcomer. That was what some of them must have thought. But we began to learn ourselves and then share what we learned with other groups of people. On weekends, we would bring groups of leaders from various parishes around the Southwest to learn from our experiences and from the people we had learned to know in the community about Hispanic people and how they must be ministered to if it is to be effective. Along that time, too, we began to develop what Ted referred to earlier, the Hispanic training program, which was an attempt to try to develop some leadership and training for Hispanic or people who might work in Hispanic work. Now this program is under the Oswald Hoffman School of Evangelism, and it's still continuing to help train students from our various colleges who are interested in cross-cultural ministry. I realized that if we were to have help and assistance in the future, we're going to have to do something ourselves to help make that happen, because we simply don't have, even to this day, a lot of that type of training program. Another part of our work was to take the existing institutions and organizations, especially VBS and Sunday School, and help them take on a mission kind of vision. So often what has happened in some of our churches is the idea of Vacation Bible School as a nurturing kind of ministry rather than a nurturing and mission strategy. I believe that the main purpose that Vacation Bible Schools were originally developed, at least, where it was to help a congregation identify unchurched homes, serve those people, make the contact through VBS, and follow up on it in such a way that new families can be incorporated into the church and into the body of Christ. So we tried to do that, and that was quite successful. In fact, several summers we had over 250 children in our Vacation Bible School, and our church only had about 250 members. So we had a lot of our people involved, and that gave a larger number of our people ownership in reaching out to Hispanic people. I think that I could honestly say at this point that the part that was most successful was working with the children because most of our people didn't feel threatened by the children. And the other thing is that the most satisfying part to me was to see Anglo people who might have been either indifferent or at least not very interested, becoming excited about outreach to other people different from themselves, and even being willing to put themselves on the line over against their other resisting members. So we made those kind of attempts. As I mentioned, the small group emphasis was a part of it, and prayer support. Now, after about 2 years, we still had not done any direct, what you might call overt Hispanic ministry to the extent of starting a Hispanic worship service or working with adults or anything like that. And it was my sense after about 2 years that this still was going to take some time. So we saw an opportunity to try to develop some Hispanic ministry with the leadership of some of our people who were getting excited in a area of El Paso about 20 miles from our church, which was in the central city. And as it turns out, a Assembly of God seminary was about to go out of business because they were growing so fast they had to have a bigger facility. And we saw the opportunity to purchase this property. Our congregation was, of course, not able to take on such a big job because that was a huge property. It had 5 acres and about 13 buildings, not in very good condition, but we could see the potential. So one of the miracles of God occurred in that we were able to convince the district Church Extension Fund and other leaders of our district to see the possibilities here. And so that property was purchased not only as a site for a Hispanic congregation, but also as a training site, which it is to this day with the Hispanic training program. That ministry has developed very well, has its own staff, Hispanic pastor, and so forth. And the neat thing about it is that some of the people who were the most resistant to Hispanic ministry in my parish were those who were most involved in the new Hispanic ministry. Can you imagine why that would be? The phenomena is that you feel guilty that this is not happening, but if you can do something about it away from your own backyard and your own parish, then you can feel at least good about that. But honestly, it was very interesting to note that the same people many times who were leaders in that ministry were often the very ones who resisted doing similar types of things in our own congregation. But that's something that we should see. And I believe that was part of our strategy, too. We were trying to start, first of all, away from our local neighborhood to see if people could get the idea and the vision, the excitement. The next step was to try to do a similar ministry in the neighborhood that was a little closer. In this case, the neighborhood that our church had begun to work in back in the last century, when it was a very new parish of immigrants coming from other parts of the United States in the downtown area about a mile and a half from our existing building. And this also was possible because the people felt a certain call to work in an area where they had had some history and some background, in a sense that, well, we had abandoned that neighborhood at one point, and now we have a responsibility to help in this area. It happened to be a community where there were very few churches, and it gave us a real chance to work among the Hispanic people, especially those who had just come from Mexico. That ministry was served primarily by lay volunteers who worked with our Sunday school and other adult programs and youth kinds of programs. And eventually, we were able to call a former vicar as the pastor, and now he... that these people represented, but a sense that this would take us in a direction that would not be, quote, successful. For you see, we had a parish made up of a lot of upper middle class people, many successful business people. And they continually drove home the point, if we start having too many poor Hispanic people in this congregation, it will drive away our giving members and those who would feel uncomfortable. And in fact, that's exactly what happened. We had members who would actually tell us and myself, I can't stay here anymore. Being around these poor people makes me feel too bad, and I just can't handle it. Now, that's a real feeling, and you know, it's easy to judge that, but I tried to help these people make what I would. But during that time, when a larger number of our youth and adults were involved directly in teaching Hispanic children and working with youth, we actually had at one point about 30 of our members taking Spanish classes to learn how to communicate more effectively with the community. And then finally, after about 8 years, 2 years before I finally left the parish, we did finally begin a Wednesday evening Bible study, and then informal worship was added shortly after that. But we never ever got to the point of having a Sunday worship or separate kind of worship service. And these Wednesday night Bible class people would come to our services on Sunday in English, and I would give them or prepare for them a summary of the sermon and some other helps that could benefit them. But still, I felt very uneasy because I knew the style of worship was perhaps not the most effective for their needs. The amazing thing was that these people were interested enough and were growing enough that they wanted to be part of a worshiping community. And this is where the real conflict came in. I believe that the real issue, finally, bottom line, was not so much the different language and culture that these people represented, but a sense that this would take us in a direction that would not be, quote, successful. For you see, we had a parish made up of a lot of upper middle class people, many successful business people, and they continually drove home the point, if we start having too many poor Hispanic people in this congregation, it will drive away our giving members and those who would feel uncomfortable. And in fact, that's exactly what happened. We had members who would actually tell us and myself, I can't stay here anymore. Being around these poor people makes me feel too bad, and I just can't handle it. Now, that's a real feeling, and you know, it's easy to judge that, but I tried to help these people make what I would call God-pleasing exits, if that's how they really felt, so that they could really recognize why they were leaving and not just put that under the rug and go on to another situation not having faced their real feelings. The problem, however, was that sometimes we didn't have the support of our neighboring congregations who were quite ready in many cases to receive these good-paying members and long-term Lutherans into their parishes. And I must say, I did feel a little disappointed about that because, in fact, our parish had given them their start, helped them by sending members to, you know, start the new congregation. Over the years, had been the solid rock kind of congregation that they looked to for direction, and that was told to us many times. But it was also quite evident that even though our people didn't see themselves as a Hispanic congregation, we often would hear statements made by the pastors of the other parishes when Hispanics would go to their church. Our Hispanic church is over there at Zion, or you would really feel more comfortable if you went to Zion, or that kind of comment, which added to the anxiety that our own people felt as they felt they were losing their identity. And then too, as I looked at all of this, I felt that we had the best chance for success in terms of a changing neighborhood situation that probably any parish could expect. We had a strong financial base, we had a lot of very strong people, a lot of families with two or three generations of people, and that all seemed very positive. the missing ingredients, in addition to the fact that we didn't have the support of neighboring churches who really understood our plight and could help us encourage our members to stay in there and try to deal with this, we didn't have the support either of the district. And I think that was not intentional. It was just that our district had wanted to do some ethnic work, and by getting involved in the other Hispanic ministry I spoke of earlier, their attitude was, we've already done our ethnic work, and so we don't really need to do anything more. We don't see why this congregation that's self-supporting can't do its own work. Why do you need our help? They didn't understand the pressures we were really dealing with and how just some encouragement from the leaders would be so helpful to me as a pastor trying to deal with all of this at one time. And so I say there's a need, and I still feel this is an important part of helping congregations in changing neighborhood situations, to aid the pastor and the key leaders with good advice and encouragement so that they can deal with the issues and not run away from them. But there's also another reason why we didn't succeed to the extent that I would like to have seen. Now, I have to say, the Lord still hasn't finished with this parish yet, and it may very well be that things can still happen in a way that will be pleasing, that will help everyone accomplish what God would like to see there. But I think a key problem was that we didn't understand soon enough, and I didn't understand soon enough, that our battle was really also spiritual. That it was not just a question of cultural change or cultural conflict, but that we really needed to see and recognize that we were in a spiritual war. I misunderstood that problem and felt that the people were just stubborn. And I didn't want to accept the fact that the devil could actually use such nice people, and in fact did on many occasions to cause disruption and difficulty for that ministry. And then I feel another very key thing having to do with not being able to do a more effective job in integrating the parish or bringing about outreach to Hispanics was the lack of sufficient staff. On many occasions, we had asked the congregation to consider calling another worker who could be working primarily with Hispanic people, and I agreed not to do that myself and let someone else do it and be the support person, the individual who could back up and encourage a Hispanic or other ethnic worker. That never happened because of financial pressures, because of lack of will. At one point, we were strong enough financially to do it. I think at this point, it would require subsidy or help from outside. And that's the typical pattern we have. Our districts and other entities don't help soon enough. The congregations don't deal with it soon enough. So consequently, we end up dealing with it from a position of weakness rather than a position of strength. Very key point that needs to be remembered. So along with the sense of frustration that we had in not being able to fulfill the goals or results that we would like to have seen, I had become myself part of the focal point of the problem. If you put your ministry and life on the line, so to speak, you can expect that some people will eventually oppose you personally. And I had people actually say to me, you know, I really like you, Pastor, as a person, but it's come to a point where your point of view and my point of view just can't coexist. And, you know, I really realized that leadership was difficult at that point. And the Lord must have realized that too, because it was about that time that I got my present call. And I think that gives you a hint as to how sometimes we deal with calls. It's not always just a call to a new ministry. It's also a sense that doors are closing and that maybe you're being called away from a ministry. I have to honestly say, too, I think that sometimes when God has given a congregation or an individual tremendous blessings and open doors, and we fail to go through those open doors, we can expect Him to begin closing some of those doors. And I think that's part of what happened in this situation. Well, now about a year and a half has passed, and the congregation still has not been able to call a pastor, because those pastors who are somewhat interested in an ethnic situation feel the way I felt when I first came. Am I going to really be given a chance to do Hispanic ministry here? Or is it going to be, you know, fighting battles and stuff like this, which is always, it's not the only place this has happened. And others are just not ready for a challenge like that. Some people sniff that there's maybe some disagreement among some of the members, so you don't want to get involved in something like that. So you can begin to see that if this vacancy goes on very long, you're going to end up with a remnant of those who are just basically the loyal few, and then at that point you're really starting from a new beginning. Now, what are the implications? I'd like to conclude with this part for the LCMS and congregations and changing neighborhoods and for you who might be going into a future ministry. Ideally, one implication is that ideally we would best do ethnic work, effective ethnic work, separate from existing Anglo ministry. I reluctantly say that, even though I believe that the body of Christ should be big enough and ample enough to include all people, all nations. But the realities of cultural differences are sometimes so great, and I think, as I said earlier, not just cultural differences, but primarily socioeconomic differences. That's the key problem. And we are a middle-class church. That's one of the reasons we have a very difficult time, I believe, working effectively with people who are poor. We just simply find it difficult to live on the land with that reality. And so we are unable to deal effectively. One of the reasons I say it's good to do ethnic work separate from the existing Anglo work is not only that you save a lot of lost time and energy that finally doesn't end up in a very positive situation anyway, because my story could be repeated so many times. The only difference in my story is that I hung in there a little longer than some people do and not quite as long as others. So, you know, it's not really that different. It's a very common pattern. I think those who've dealt with this would agree. But I think a key issue here is also a missiological point, and that is that of ownership. I know Hispanics and Asians especially, other groups probably as well, need a sense of ownership. Is this our church? Is this a place I can invite my family and friends where they would feel like they're welcome, or is this a place where they're going to have to ask permission to use the bathroom or going to be blamed for breaking the plate in the kitchen or whatever it is? Are we going to be treated like equal members of the body of Christ or like second-class citizens in the kingdom of God? That would be a key issue. And even if it's a small storefront kind of a building, which might sound like it's not the greatest way to go, if it's theirs, it really might make a better beginning than trying to do it on top of another situation. If it is because of lack of finances or because of the circumstances necessary to work in an Anglo setting, I think the next best solution is to share the building but not the pastor. I really believe that we had a good chance of making it in our parish if we had only had another worker who could have been the one that the Hispanic people identified with, and then I was able, I believe, to run interference for that individual, help them deal with some of the conflicts, perhaps better than even some other Anglo pastors since I had dealt with this myself. So the multi-staff idea is essential. And then there's a need to reconsider structure for effective ethnic work. Our districts are not really set up all the time for effective ethnic work, I believe, because a lot of our well-meaning executives simply have had little experience with ethnic ministry and do not understand that the stewardship realities, for example, are very different. You have people, in the case of Hispanics, who saw the church as their mother rather than them as those people who care for the church and who build it up, etc. So my suggestion would be to somehow develop a structure which would allow for 4 to 6 ethnic advisors in various regions of the country who would be available to help ethnic ministries develop and work with the district mission executives and others to assist in working through just the kinds of problems I've illustrated already, and helping churches learn from one another and not repeat the same mistakes that some districts already have gone through. Also, there's a need for long-term commitment to ethnic ministry in changing neighborhood situations. We need to recognize that these ministries do not become self-supporting overnight, and that there's a need for a longer-term commitment. there is a need for different approaches with different ethnic groups. For example, Asians are usually more secure and able to work with Anglo groups and can be able to share a building, perhaps easier than Hispanics, who are typically more passive and perhaps somewhat more intimidated. All church workers, including seminarians, I think, need more acculturation and cross-cultural training for the future to be able to deal effectively with what we're going to deal with. We need key bridge builders, in any case, people who are both of an ethnic background and Anglo people who are sensitive, who can be the bridges between these cultural groups and who have the love and the patience to help bring about the peace and harmony that is needed for effective ministry. And even if you aren't called to a congregation in a changing neighborhood, the chances are that you will eventually work near one. You could be that supportive pastor, the one who helps your neighboring pastor and congregation deal with their struggle, instead of just closing your eyes and walking by on the other side. And there's a need, finally, for these congregations that have become viable ethnic congregations to relate to the existing dominant church structure, so they are going to need those bridge builders to help that occur. We're going to need to recognize the worship needs of all the people, including not only the Anglo majority or minority, depending on what that becomes, but also that of other ethnic groups who, because of cultural differences, require a little different approach. And we need to make sure that the decision-making process is appropriate for the group. For example, in the case of Hispanics, the democratic process may not be the most appropriate form of church government. That is just foreign to their cultural tradition. And many more points could be raised, but these are some of the key ones. And now the opportunities and blessings that are available to us as we look at the changing neighborhood reality for the church and for you as individuals. I really don't want to end without mentioning at least a couple of these things, because otherwise I think it would leave the wrong impression with you that we're saying changing neighborhood situations, ethnic ministry equals problems. Certainly, any ministry that's worth doing involves some challenge, but there are many opportunities and blessings for the church and for you personally. One of those opportunities is the fact that ethnics, Asians, Hispanics, and others help us reevaluate our emphasis on individualism and to re-study the need to strengthen the family. Hispanic people are especially strong in this regard, and sometimes I have to believe that the Lord is sending so many Hispanics and Asians to our country at this particular juncture, because that's exactly when we're struggling as families to keep it all together, because they have a tradition which is helpful to our churches and to our families. Another opportunity is that this reality provides a way for us to renew our worship and congregational life. A little example will say more than a lot of words. There's a congregation in Oakland, California that I got to know a few years ago that saw the changing neighborhood situation. And before the first Hispanic came into that congregation, they began to realize their future was really in that direction. And so they did all kinds of things to prepare for that reality in that day when the first Hispanic would come into their midst. They started learning Spanish. They sang some Spanish hymns in their service. They had elements of their liturgy in Spanish. They put banners on the wall and a lot of those kinds of things. 2 years later, when the first Hispanics came into the church, they were overwhelmed with the kind of reception they received and were totally amazed that this group of, in this case, black Lutherans were willing to receive them in this way. Why were these people so ready to change? Because they themselves had been through a similar experience and thereby were more caring and more understanding of the kinds of challenges people face. We need to see that by doing something like this congregation in Oakland, we can enjoy the richness of art and language and music, and we don't have to give up a thing, but actually we're enriched by this experience of sharing the cultural heritages of our other people. Another opportunity is to help build bridges of understanding between races and cultures. My belief is that if we can't do it in the church, it's not very likely that we're going to see it happening in society. So the church must see this as an opportunity to build bridges. As we gather around word and sacrament, we can sense that we are one body, and we can believe that we are serving the same Christ. We have an opportunity to do theology as we prepare for confirmation classes and Sunday school programs, which are culturally acceptable and biblically sound. You see, our missionaries in Africa right now have to prepare classes and materials for all levels of the church, from teaching parents how to lead devotions without even knowing how to read, all the way to formal seminary programs. These people don't have a CPH to write to. They have to prepare everything from scratch. That forces you to do theology, and it makes you in the process into a better theologian and a stronger pastor. So it's an opportunity to grow and to be more effective in ministry in every sense. And as our society moves more and more toward a non-critical pluralism, we have an opportunity to speak again the truth that Christ is the way, the truth, and the life, and that we are people of courage who believe that and live by that and are ready to hold that up. And finally, I'd just like to say that instead of resisting the challenge that God is giving us or refusing to serve in that type of ministry, if you're called to do so, see it as a high privilege and opportunity to be on the cutting edge of the church's ministry in the 20th century. See it as a chance to help bring the gospel to all people groups and nationalities, as Christ's Great Commission calls us to do. And believe Christ's promise in the Great Commission, where he says that he will be with us, even in challenging ministries, even in the challenging ministry of a changing neighborhood and society. Thank you for letting me be with you. I'm sorry I went over a few minutes, but hopefully this has been somewhat helpful to you.
We want to thank Pastor Huey. If anyone has any questions, he will be around for a little bit, but he does have a meeting coming up at the International Center. So for a few minutes, if you're interested, you can ask questions of him. I'm sure he'd be more than glad to address any concerns you might have. Thank you very much.